I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The funeral service for slain Baltimore police detective Sean Souter is underway at this hour at a church in East Baltimore. Detective Souter was one of 316 people killed to date this year in Baltimore. 7 people have been killed in the 2 weeks since Detective Souter's death. Mayor Catherine Pugh has described the violence that plagues Baltimore as out of control. Today, a conversation with 2 members of the Baltimore City Council whose job it is, along with the mayor and others, to control it. John Bullock represents the West Side and Southwest Baltimore, and Zeke Cohen represents downtown neighborhoods adjacent to the Inner Harbor. They join me to talk about strategies to reduce crime, lift people out of poverty, and turn the tide in our city. First, the news. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for this edition of Midday. Today, our focus is on Baltimore City. We've invited 2 of the newest members of the Baltimore City Council to join us this afternoon to get their reflections as they complete their first year in office. The 8 members of the council who won election for the first time last year are seen to have dramatically changed the dynamics of the legislative process. A few months ago, we spoke with freshman council members Shannon Sneed, Leon Pinkett, and Ryan Dorsey. Today, we welcome Dr. John T. Bullock, who represents the 9th Councilmanic District. That includes West and Southwest Baltimore. Before being elected to the council, he was an assistant professor of political science at Towson University and the executive director of the Downtown Baltimore Family Alliance. He and his wife are the proud parents of 2 sons, Thomas and George, and they live in Union Square. Councilman, good to see you, sir.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks.
Zeke Cohen joins us as well. He represents the 1st District, which includes Canton, Fells Point, Greektown, and O'Donnell Heights, among other places. He taught in local public schools as a member of Teach for America and later went on to found The Intersection, which works on college readiness and leadership schools for high school students. He lives in Canton, and if my memory is correct, you are engaged to be married. Is that right, sir?
I am married and about to have my first child.
Oh, you're actually married. I'm way behind on Facebook. All right. Well, Zeke Cohen, welcome to Midday. It's good to see you, and congratulations on the upcoming kid. Like the entire 14-member council, Dr. Bullock and Mr. Cohen are Democrats. They were elected in November 2016, along with 6 other candidates who all joined the council for the first time when they were sworn into office on December 8th of last year. So what are the issues that most animate them, and what are the issues that most animate you? You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, gentlemen, last week, Rod Rosenstein, the former federal prosecutor here in Maryland, now the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, gave a speech in Chicago to a bunch of lawyers, and he said that the Baltimore City Mayor, Mayor Pugh, admits that crime is out of control. That's a quote. That's something that Mayor Pugh did say a couple of weeks ago. And so Rosenstein goes on to say, if that is true, people should be held accountable. Crime is not like the weather. If crime is out of control, it is because people failed to control it. In Baltimore, local authorities lost confidence in their ability to manage public safety, the most important function of government. So, Councilman Bullock, do you agree with Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein's assessment that if crime is out of control, it's because people are failing to control it?
Well, I'll say this. You know, the one thing that he mentioned was accountability, and I think we all have to be held accountable. That becomes the mayor, the city council. It's also the police, but it's also our neighborhoods as well. And so one of the things I say in community meetings, and I have a lot of neighborhoods that are quite challenged as it relates to crime, you know, if you see something, say something. And that's in terms of what we do in terms of our neighborhoods, but then also looking at, you know, the police. And we've had challenges in our city, clearly going back from prior to 2015 and the unrest, looking at relationships between communities and police, and there being distrust there being some negative relationships. And then also, what do we do in terms of legislators and public officials? So the mayor has issued a crime plan, but also the Public Safety Committee, they have also issued a crime plan and how we address this, because we have to look at it not only from law enforcement, but then also programs like Safe Streets. You know, as a council, you know, during the budget season, we were all pretty much united on dealing with some of the solutions in terms of crime. So it's not just on the back end, but about the front end. So investments in education, I know Councilman Cohen will talk about that, but also things like Safe Streets to try to interrupt violence. So we have to look at it from a multi-pronged approach, and then thinking about education, jobs, it's all intertwined, and you can't separate one piece, but we're all accountable.
And Councilman Cohen, there are people who are really in a state of despair about what appears to be the intractability of this problem of crime. And of course, you know, to call it the problem of crime while as we speak, Detective Souter is being laid to rest. And since Detective Souter was killed 2 weeks ago, 10 more people have been killed. We are now at a homicide rate of 317. It was 316 2 hours ago when I recorded the billboard. And another one was announced, a person who was killed late last night, an unidentified man who's about 50 years old. In 2016, our number was 318. So we are about to reach that hideous milestone of equaling the horrible number of murders last night. What about Rosenstein's contention that it's not like the weather? If it's out of control, it's because people aren't controlling it.
So, look, let me be clear. There is nothing more serious or that doesn't demand more of a sense of urgency in our city than the violence that we're experiencing. But that being said, violence is multifaceted, just like my colleague said. And where I think our city has sometimes gone down the wrong path is that we assume that when crime spikes, police are the only ones that can solve it. And so we put all of our eggs into a basket that, frankly, police officers were not designed to do. Just like Councilman said, there are so many interventions that lead that can interrupt the cycle before someone heads down the path of violence. For example, we've talked a lot in my education committee about having more services in our schools to address trauma. We know that the majority of children that are both victims of and perpetrators of violent crime have themselves experienced several traumatic incidents. As a city, we need to wrap ourselves around our most vulnerable kids and our most vulnerable populations and make sure we're doing everything we can to prevent them from either becoming a victim or a perpetrator. And I would just say that while I understand the deep frustration and anguish that many people are feeling, and I share it myself, I also think this is a profound moment of hope for our city, an opportunity. We have a new council, we have a new mayor, we have so much good that's happening in Baltimore. I know we're going to talk a little bit later about the Youth Fund, but when I look around our city, and just yesterday I was with some young people from the Building Steps program who were delivering care packages to folks at Healthcare for the Homeless, the vast majority of children and people in our city are good, and their stories don't get told enough. And I think we as a city need to do a better job of telling our own story, which is that we have deep challenges, but they are not intractable. They were caused by human beings, and they can be solved by human beings. And we also have so many people that are working to make Baltimore the great American comeback story that I know it's going to be.
And Councilman Bullock, you mentioned confidence, the lack of confidence in the communities of color and the police, which were brought to very much the fore after the uprising and the scathing report by the Department of Justice, which led to a consent decree being issued. And now we have a monitor. We'll talk about that in a second. But there's also confidence within the political establishment. Just yesterday, Governor Larry Hogan told Aaron Cox of the Baltimore Sun that he frankly doesn't have much confidence in the plan that Mayor Pugh has adduced to solve the crime issue or to address the violence in the city of Baltimore. I mean, that seemed in a certain way a very extraordinary comment for two politicians who, you know, putatively get along. I mean, Mayor Pugh, when she was a senator, you know, worked closely with the governor. They seem to have, for example, a much better relationship than the previous mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, had with Governor Hogan. What's your confidence level about the mayor's plan, about Brandon Scott and his committee, the Public Safety Committee's plan? I mean, is this plan the blueprint, the way forward to addressing this horrible spike in crime?
No, it's a great question. You know, first is thinking about, you know, from the governor's perspective, you know, I think it's important that if you're going to have critique of the city, that you're also committing the resources for the city. And we can talk about programs like CORE that have been great in terms of neighborhood revitalization and development. But we also look at projects like the Red Line that was killed and would have a dramatic impact on, in terms of what the city could do economically and as far as transportation. So I think that's something to be considered. As far as, you know, confidence in the mayor's plan, in light of also, you know, Brandon Scott's plan as chair of the Public Safety Committee, I think sometimes we look at things as being either or things being at odds. But I think we have to look at it from a holistic point of view and say, hey, you know, the Public Safety Plan or Public Safety Committee, part of that had to deal with some of the other ancillary issues, not only in terms of safe streets, but also how do we deal with education? How do we deal with the whole child? How do we deal with issues of trauma? I think that's very important. I think it's also important to make sure that we're holding the mayor accountable. The difference between the mayor and the city council is that we can do create legislation, we can work with our city agencies, but the council does not control the city agencies. And so if you look at, you know, the mayor's office and the relationship she has with the police commissioner, I think that is a place where we have to have some serious questions being asked. Again, I think she's working toward it, but clearly right now it requires more of a solution. No, saying that crime is out of control, that's one thing, but we have to have a targeted plan, and I don't think we're there just yet.
But let me ask you to clarify that for me in terms of the mayor's relationship with Commissioner Davis. Mm-hmm. And for what it's worth, the governor expressed great confidence in Commissioner Davis, but he was not willing to express that same level of confidence in Mayor Pugh. I mean, what's your take on that relationship between those two, between Ms. Pugh and Mr. Davis?
You know, I think it's interesting in that, you know, she came into office and inherited Commissioner Davis. At this point, they seem to have a functional relationship, which I think is a good thing between the mayor and the police commissioner. However, some critique and say, hey, is she pushing the police commissioner enough? The other side you can say is that all these problems look so easy from the outside, right? So if you live outside the city, if you're just saying, hey, why can't the police commissioner solve it, or why can't the mayor or the city council just solve it? Sometimes it seems oversimplistic. But right now it seems like they have a good relationship, but I don't know to what extent they are pushing each other. And I think in any relationship, there has to be that tension, whether it be coming from the mayor or from the police commissioner, in terms of what we can do to actually solve some of these issues.
Zeke Cohen, let me play for you, and Councilman Bullock, let me play for you a clip of the mayor who was talking about one of the responses to this heavy spike in crime, which was a bill that went through the city council concerning mandatory minimum sentencing.
We know that violence is up all around the country. You know, even in our counties, surrounding our counties, we see violence like we've never seen it before. But it is a problem with guns. We have too many guns on our streets. As you well know, during this legislative session with the city council, we put forth legislation to make it mandatory when someone is caught with an illegal gun on the streets of our city that they get a mandatory sentence, mm-hmm. and that was watered down, so that doesn't take place. We will still go before the legislature trying to push that same legislation, because what we found, and if you noted the data, 89% of the individuals committing crimes on our streets have been in contact with the criminal justice system,
right.
9 to 11 times. And so these are people who continue to victimize our city, and we've got to get them off the streets of our city.
And put them in jail.
In jail, yes.
See, Cohen, you know, so many people have shown that the data suggests very strongly that we're not going to be able to incarcerate our way out of this problem. However, you can certainly understand people's reaction. You know, you've got groups of kids pushing runners into the Inner Harbor while they're jogging after work. You've got people being accosted in all sorts of neighborhoods around our city, not just the four or five neighborhoods and zip codes like the one where I live, where it's been historically neighborhoods that have been plagued by crime. I mean, Councilman Bullock represents, among other places, Harlem Park, which is where Detective Souter was killed investigating a triple shooting the year before. But when it comes to things like things that can be done immediately, because people talk to jobs, opportunities, education, trauma counseling, those are long-term solutions. For your constituents who are saying, what about now? What's your response?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, there is nothing more urgent to myself or my colleagues than the violence that we're experiencing. And I will just say, as the personal victim of a violent crime, I was robbed at gunpoint a couple of years ago in my bedroom, still have nightmares and trauma from it. I know how deeply it impacts people when they are victims of violent crime. And like you said, Tom, This has not just been isolated into areas of high poverty. It's been all over our city, although I will say still greatly disproportionately in our most impoverished neighborhoods. In my district,
yes.
O'Donnell Heights has experienced several murders since I've been in office, and it is deeply troubling. But other parts of my district have also experienced murders, have also experienced assaults, have also experienced robberies and carjackings, and none of it is acceptable. And to be completely clear, anyone who commits a violent crime must be held fully accountable. However, when we say that we want to learn from our history, when we say that we want to evolve as a city, and then our immediate response is to either try to wave more juveniles into adult prison or go to what looks to a lot of people to be like zero tolerance or mandatory minimums, my question is, are we taking a step back into an era that in many ways created the problems that we're dealing with today? You just said we cannot incarcerate our way out of this problem. We can't lock enough people up. And frankly, we already tried that as a city. Under a previous administration, we locked up over 100,000, over a sixth of our population. Well, guess what? We're living with the results of that policy decision. Many of the children that are out here committing these crimes are the children of incarcerated people or victims of violent crimes themselves. And so, again, it is not to say that we should not have harsh penalties. And just to be clear, at the state level, there is a 5-year mandatory minimum for anyone caught in possession of a gun committing a crime. And so that should be out there publicly. However, it is to say that as a council, or I'll speak for myself, my focus is preventing crimes before they occur, making sure our communities are equipped to deal with violence, making sure our police are active and engaged with community members, supporting violence interruption programs that we know from data work, like Safe Streets, 27% reduction in shootings in a long comprehensive study. That's where investment needs to go. And then into, and I know I'll talk about this later, but community schools. Baltimore is a leader across the nation in this innovative model. In 2018, we're going to have the National Community School Conference. This is a program that is healing communities, bringing together schools and community associations in neighborhoods where often tension has existed, where young people have been left behind. These are the types of interventions that we need to support and we need to throw our political muscle behind.
Zeke Cohen represents District 1 on the Baltimore City Council. John Bullock represents the 9th District. We'll have more with Council Members Cohen and Bullock after a quick break, and we will take your calls and comments. We've got a few folks lined up in the queue on the phone. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To find us on Twitter, @midday. Tom Hall, stay with us. And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the program tomorrow, Heather Mazier joins me to talk about her latest project called Soul Force Politics. She has a podcast and she offers women empowerment workshops, and she makes the case that spirituality should not be divorced from our political discourse. We'll explore the intersection of what she calls inner wisdom and external actions and how that can animate political movements tomorrow right here on Midday, where we'll also check in with theater critic Jay Wynn Russick. She's going to review The Lion King at the Hippodrome Theater. If you're just joining us today, my guests are two of the 8 new members of the Baltimore City Council, John Bullock, who represents the 9th District, and Zeke Cohen, who represents District 1. We welcome your calls, your emails, and tweets, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, to find us on Twitter, @midday. Tom Hall. So, Councilman, let's go to the phones. Angela in Mount Vernon, welcome to the show. Thanks for your call.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I find it interesting that in the midst of this opioid epidemic, we are all reflecting now, and of course, with the research and everything, we have deemed drug addiction a medical problem, whereas in the 80s, when the epidemic of crack cocaine was a brown problem, it was deemed a moral issue. The same things that create drug addiction, that lead people to seek out substances to alter their state of reality, are the same things that create crime and poverty. And it's not going to be long before Carroll County, who has deemed it necessary to keep their children from coming to Baltimore City because there's so much crime, before yet again these people who deem it moral and or amoral to live in communities that are plagued by crime, by gun violence, that they're going to be touched. We keep deeming these things moral problems. We keep disassociating ourselves and seeing ourselves as separate when certain communities are in the midst of these issues.
All right. Well, thank you for that comment, Angela. I appreciate it. Councilman Bullock, Harlan Park, where Detective mm-hmm. Souter was killed the other 2 weeks ago, is in your district. Mm-hmm. And this is a place where there are any number of violent incidents over a long, mm-hmm. long generational mm-hmm. span of time.
Right. So let's talk about it from that perspective, because I think the caller makes an interesting point in talking about, you know, how issues of drugs or crime are perceived and even geographically. So, for instance, you know, I'm 39 years old. I grew up during the crack era and looking at mass incarceration, all the challenges that come along with that. Oftentimes what's happened in cities like Baltimore is that the rest of the state and others can just, you know, turn a blind eye to these issues. But now these issues are affecting them. So I thought on one hand, and I know not only myself, but the council president has said some other things akin to this. But on one hand, you have many who from Carroll County who will say, hey, we're not going to send our young people to the city for school trips and cultural experiences that would be beneficial to them. But the reality is that many people are coming from Carroll County and Harford County, other counties, to come into Baltimore specifically to buy drugs. And the reality is that it's part of the reason why that opioid crisis is expanding. And not only do we have a number of folks who are coming to the city to purchase drugs, but then also looking at the over-concentration of drug rehab facilities within our cities that's having a negative impact on these communities. You mentioned Harlan Park. I represent the lower part of Sandtown and Harlan Park, and we're talking about houses and neighborhoods that were historically beautiful. Now, what's happened in places like Baltimore and others is that we've lost a significant amount of our population. That population peak at 950,000 in 1950 is down to 614,000. Where do those people go? Many of them went to those outlying counties. They took with them their resources. They took with them the tax base. And so what you left behind was a fractured shell of what a community once was, without the jobs, without the infrastructure, without those resources and the positive role models within those communities. And so, you know, it's important for us to recognize that many have contributed to this problem either by lack of attention or by, just tuning out from some of these issues, but those issues do affect them. And we have to be clear about that.
And Zeke Cohen, before we take a few more calls, and there is a long queue, and I will try to get to as many of them as we can, but I do want to talk about this Youth Empowerment Fund. This is a $12 million fund that has now been made available per referendum by Baltimore voters last November. Tell us what that money is intended to do, and talk about Council President Young's suggestion that it be administered, at least in the early stages and the initial time, by the Associated Black Charities, which is a nonprofit, non-city related agency.
Yeah. So when I spoke earlier about feeling a great sense of hope about our city, the Youth Fund is something that really comes to mind for me. And just to set the stage, last week there was a tremendous march from the Kids Safe Zone in Sandtown, Winchester, to Frederick Douglass High School that was led by young people in support of the Youth Fund. And then we held a hearing in the Education Committee that I chair to hear about the legislation, and then we unanimously passed it. But to see young people stepping up, I mean, hundreds of young people from every neighborhood in our city coming together in support of this Youth Fund was just incredibly powerful. And then to hear the testimonies of young people who are in these programs, who are so deeply resilient, who've been through so much themselves, to hear them speak about what after school and community school programming means to them, it just, again, it restores my faith.
Who's going to get the money and who should get the money? Because one of the focuses of this, as I understand it, is to give money to organizations, perhaps they're smaller organizations, yep, they're less well-known, they're not as established as, you know, nonprofits who have staffs and offices and people to run them. I mean, how do you get the money, yep, from Associated Black Charities to those people?
Yeah, so what's unique about this fund, it is the largest youth fund in the country that is entirely community controlled. But what I mean by that is, in order to get the legislation that we passed through my committee, there was a task force that met in public. It had 36 members. They came up with a series of recommendations. The top three I would mention: one, that community control the fund. So regular people who are in neighborhoods, that they should have a voice in how the funds are distributed. Two, that there should be a lens toward equity. So when you spoke about smaller, often Black-led grassroots nonprofits that have not traditionally had access to capital, that they would have a doorway into this fund. And that's not to say that, of course, everyone can apply, everyone is eligible, any organization, but that this community-based process should try to lift up organizations that have not traditionally been funded in the past and are doing good work. And third, and this is what's so important to me, that young people actually have a voice not only in receiving the funds, but in distributing them. So for the first year and a half, Associated Black Charities is going to be the fiduciary holder of the fund. Their job is to assess the landscape, do an analysis of all the organizations across the city, and then begin to build a community-based board that will be tasked with distributing this money. And again, what's so important to me is that that board have a major component that is youth voice. And I just want to say, Tom, no one else in the country is doing this. There's no other place that has empowered young people and community to have a $12 million annual fund to be spent on small organizations that are really saving lives within our communities.
And of course, you know, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, when she was the mayor, vetoed the bill that would have made this possible. And she had real concerns about the bond rating and,
correct,
about the impact on the city budget. So there could be a reason that nobody else in the country is doing it. It's because it's not an upside kind of thing.
There could be, but we got to listen to our citizens. And when 86% of people that voted for this thing, to me, that says clearly that folks want something different. They want to see community control. They want to see young people in a position of authority. And I fundamentally believe that if we teach young people how to be grant officers, if we teach them the skills, if we are all sort of privy to a strong equity analysis, we can start to shift the dynamics within our city.
Let's go to Dale in Greenmount West. Dale, welcome to Midday with Councilman Cohen and Councilman Bullock.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom.
Yes, sir. How you doing?
Hello. Yeah. Good afternoon, and good afternoon to you, guests. Look, I'm going to keep it pretty short. I'm very disappointed with the city's policies in regards to how they award public contracts, and I've discussed this with my city council members. There are too many companies doing business with the city of Baltimore, and I suspect a majority of their workforce is undocumented. And the city does nothing to make sure that everybody is abiding by the rules. I've never asked them to do anything above the law. It's a federal law. Every one of your councilmen filled out an I-9 form when they started their job with city government. We should require all contractors to comply with the law. And that will solve some of the employment disparities that exist in the community. I got guys approaching me all the time about work.
All right,
Dale. I tell them to go to the city, and they say they've done that already.
All right, Dale. Well, thanks for the comment. Dr. Bullock, do you buy the narrative that says there are undocumented people who are not here in the country legally who are taking jobs from people who otherwise would take those jobs?
Well, I'll say at this point, I know that for my colleague, again, he has probably a higher percentage of immigrants who are in his community, some documented and some undocumented. But I'll make this point. One of the things that hits folks acutely, and I'll say for Green Mile West and other neighborhoods, when folks see development projects or they see folks who are working on these projects and they recognize the high rate of poverty and unemployment in their neighborhoods, I definitely understand why that strikes a nerve. We, you know, have talked about this at the council level in terms of local hiring, how important that is. I know many of our colleagues, our supporters, and also some of our friends in the labor movement have also brought up some of these issues too, as it relates down to local hiring and local training and what happens on these jobs. Because we know there are a number of economic development opportunities in our city and a number of projects, and we want to make sure that folks from the neighborhoods are being hired. That's one of the reasons why I really do believe in these community benefits agreements. Because if you can spell out at the outset, what are our expectations as it relates to hiring, right? What does it mean as it relates to training? Because again, we don't want to leave neighborhoods behind. The same thing you talk about in some of our neighborhoods that are struggling, we have to create pipelines for employment. And whether that's on a private sector or on a public sector, we have to make sure that we're training through apprenticeship programs. Some of it's getting young people engaged early on in terms of the workforce. Some of it's being retrained. I think we also have to be clear in terms of what we can do with our community college, whether it be BCCC or CCBC. How are we training folks for the jobs of the future? And I know there's some partnerships with our high schools, also trying to get these associate degrees as folks are getting these high school diplomas to make sure that they're able to get the jobs. Because one of the knocks or one of the reasons why some folks say they don't hire localists is the skills gap. And so if we want to make sure we close that gap so that that's not an excuse in terms of local hiring.
We have an email from Chrissy, who I think speaks for a lot of people who do still have an affinity and an affection for the city. And she says, as a member of the Baltimore community, what can I do as an individual to contribute to solving the heightened crime issues that face our city? I live in Midtown. What are ways that individuals can get involved with making our city better? And Zeke Cohen, it's interesting. I mean, here are you two guys who have been very active as activists before you ran for city government. You represent the two Baltimores, so acutely. You know, we have Councilman Bullock with neighborhoods like Harlan Park, Sandtown, where there's just nothing going on, and we have Canton and Harbor East, where you part of the district of Zeke Cohen that you represent, and you can't find a parking space, and you can hardly drive down there. There's so much development going on. You know, there's another Whole Foods being built down there. I mean, to replace the one that's already there. I mean, the contrast couldn't be more stark.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, we probably represent 4, 5, 6 Baltimores. I mean, it's, this sort of idea that there's one Baltimore that's thriving and there's another that's, been chronically neglected is true, but there's also all these other sub-communities, right? In my district, we have a large and growing immigrant population, to the previous caller's point, who has also faced an incredible amount of stress and trauma, largely due to who our president is, and who are also, by the way, the quickest to get exploited on job sites, is our immigrant and undocumented community, who often get paid under the table and the wages are not up to par. So I agree with the assessment that we need to make sure that we are enforcing all of our labor laws in the city of Baltimore, because I'm tired of seeing my community get exploited in that kind of a way. To the caller's question, look, I think now more than ever, local participation is so critically important. I think that our federal government is largely jammed up. We'll see what happens with this tax plan. I do not have a great deal of faith in the administration in Washington. And so I think that local government and local community is in such an important role in this moment, not just for Baltimore, but for our country. So much of it has fallen down to us. So I think whatever that means within the local context of your community, whether that means showing up at the community association, whether that means volunteering at the local school, we all need to be in this together. There is no politician that's going to save the city or save the country. It's going to be all of us working together. That's how democracy works. It's messy and sticky, and we all have a role to play. And so whatever that looks like, to the person who sent the email, find it And start working in partnership.
Zeke Cohen represents the 1st District on the Baltimore City Council. John Bullock represents the 9th District. We'll have more with Mr. Cohen and Dr. Bullock when we return from a quick break. Dave and Jay are on the line. Stay there, sirs. We will get to you as soon as we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to find us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Stay there. And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Just about a year ago, the dynamics of the Baltimore City Council changed dramatically when 8 new members of the 14-member body were sworn in. If you've just joined us, we're talking to 2 of those members, John Bullock of District 9 and Zeke Cohen of District 1. They and their other freshman colleagues on the council have proven themselves to be a very activist group. So what's on your mind that you would like to share with John Bullock and Zeke Cohen this afternoon? 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to find us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. As promised, we're going back to the phones. Dave in Guilford, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Tom. Am I coming through?
Yes, sir.
Congratulations on this. This is just where the media should be. To me, I heard the solution when I went to a presentation by Ceasefire. Safe Streets also might be where the money should go, and I hope that the adults in the room, and I went to the last meeting of the Mayor's Coordinating Council on Criminal Justice where Rosenstein attended. I think he's blaming the victim, which would be true to a Republican, but we need the people that are affected, Ceasefire, the young people, people that go to the hospital when the shooting victims come in, people of that age. I'm afraid the Mayor's Coordinating Council seemed out of touch. These councilmen on your program do not seem out of touch. Have they had a presentation by Ceasefire? Could they schedule one? Can we get the money to the kids that know what's going on and that are affected?
That's my thought. Thanks for the thought, Dave. John Bullock, Safe Streets, a program that's currently administered by the health department. There's some talk that it may move to a different department, but wherever it lasts, there is a lot of data that says these folks who do interventions,
right,
these are folks from the community, and many of them have had themselves serious interactions with the justice system. For example, this $12 million youth development fund, I mean, can any of that money go to Safe Streets, or is that going to be, you know, allocated completely on programs of different sort?
So the youth fund would be a separate issue. However, it's one of the reasons why we fought for having funding for Safe Streets in the last budget season, and we're committed to doing so again. You know, you mentioned it coming from a public health perspective. When you look at it as an epidemic, how do you deal with an epidemic? You have to go at the root, at the source. And so, you know, as you mentioned, think about some of those violence interrupters. You know, I can say, yes, I grew up in an urban environment, but my story is different than someone who could say, I've carried a gun, I've been in the streets, and I know how to de-escalate the conflict. And so that's one of the things I think is so important. And then the caller also mentions the Ceasefire movement. I'm so happy that came up, because now we're talking about really a grassroots approach. You know, we're not going to police our way out of it. There's a cultural shift that has to happen in our city where violence is not acceptable. The loss of one life is one life too many. And so whether it's having a cookout, whether it's, you know, having a block party, having those conversations, you know, mediation is so important. One of the things we recognize in many of these communities is the inability to resolve conflicts in a safe manner. And so if you can have someone who has credibility in the streets and come to you and say, hey, put the guns down, let's deal with this, that's going to be a more effective solution. So it can't be either or. Yes, we have to look at issues of policing, but yes, we have to look at programs like Safe Streets. And again, making sure that the funding is in place so that we can do it.
Yeah, Baltimore Ceasefire had another Ceasefire weekend a few weeks ago. The next one, if I'm correct in recalling, is in February. They're also going to have one over Mother's Day weekend in May. So that is a movement that is, as you say, Zeke Cohen and John Bullock, a grassroots movement by some very committed women who are doing some incredible work. Jay in Canton, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
So, you know, I believe that this is, you know, not the fault of anybody who's on the radio now in terms of where we are in the city of Baltimore. I believe the root cause was started based on legislation and policy, you know, 50 years ago, and has been obviously part of this deindustrialization process. I think that part of the solution is going to be a jobs-related solution. We know that jobs, if you believe that jobs are part of the answer, what you may also want to know is that more people have come out of poverty in the last 20 years than at any other time in the history of the world. And they did come out of poverty because of youth development funds and government programs that are, in my mind, some sort of palliative care, which may be necessary in some terms, but understand that whenever you add these costs, you're pulling away from the fabric of the ecosystem that is supposed to create those jobs. Those jobs are created by creating an environment that's conducive to job growth. You can't do that by mandating government programs. As I said, we've had a lot of success around the world creating jobs, but they were not created because of government programs. What we need to do is take a step back and define what the root cause was and define. And by the way, if you think that this $12 million youth development fund, of which I will gladly say if we can set up benchmarks, I will donate to everybody's campaign that's on the radio thousands of dollars if we can hit those benchmarks. But I think that what we're going to find from this is the same thing we found 5, 10, 15, and 20 years ago. The same, you know, pushing, you know, oh, if we just do this, if we do this, it's going to help. We have to have a deep reflection to understand that Baltimore City is not a place that businesses want to move to. Not, you know, the crime and the education problems are consequences of the bad policies sure. that were put in place 50
All right,
years
Jay,
ago.
Jay, we got you. I appreciate the call. Zeke Cohen, there's a movement afoot, for example, to get the large institutions in town, places like Hopkins, and large philanthropies who have these gigantic endowments, and they do a lot of philanthropic work, but to require a particular, a certain percentage of their endowments to be invested in job creation and entrepreneurs who are willing to establish businesses here in the city. That's one of many ideas that are in the bailiwick, in the general wheelhouse of what Jay is talking about in terms of making Baltimore an attractive place to start a business.
Yeah, absolutely. And so where I agree with Jay is that we have had a pattern of disinvestment, and I would say it goes back longer than 50 years ago. But to me, what I see with this council, with this youth fund, is an opportunity to invest in the communities that have been most underserved. And I don't think we've ever truly embraced that mission as a city. And that's why it gives me such a tremendous sense of hope. To the point of jobs, critically important. One of the initiatives I'm going to be working on in the next year is around job, college and career readiness. What we hear a lot, and Councilman Bullock mentioned this earlier, is that there's what employers sometimes call a skills gap. We need to do more to invest within our education system, within the Mayor's Office of Economic Development, and with the business, for-profit and nonprofit sector to really all wrap our arms around this challenge. There is a profound disconnect between what I see as an emerging and booming industry sector in this town that is truly happening, at least what I see in my district, and Jay is an example of it, and the young people who are not there, kids who are not getting access to these jobs, whether they be in cybersecurity, whether they be in healthcare, whether they be in Under Armour. So we got to figure out how to create an on-ramp between youth that are growing up in this city and this new and emerging economy. I think a lot of it will have to do with entrepreneurialism and having our young people have the capital that others have historically had access to. And I think a lot of it will have to do with all of us, businesses, government, nonprofit, making this a priority and saying in this moment of angst for Baltimore, we have to be all in on college and career readiness for these young people. Because I agree with Jay's premise that the move forward for Baltimore is to have a city full of young people that are ready for the next economy.
And John Bullock, what's the difference in your narrative, which I don't by any means know intimately, mm-hmm. and the narrative of the people that you're representing in places like Harlan Park mm-hmm. and Sandtown? I mean, you grew up in an urban environment. You grew up here in Baltimore. You have a PhD in political science. You've got a wonderful stable family, and now you're in politics and you're a leader here in our city. What's how do you how does John Bullock end up there, and the kids that are currently, you know, 8 and 10 and 14 years old in Harlem Park and Sandtown Winchester, how do they end up in a place that's parallel to that?
You know, a lot of it has to do, you know, I can't take credit for all of it, because a lot of it has to do with my family, right? I mean, having, you know, two parents at home, even though, you know, they didn't go to college, and, you know, they wanted me to be my best, and they really invested and pushed me to be my best. Teachers who played a huge role. You know, I'm the first generation in my family to go to college, but that wouldn't have been possible without scholarships and having teachers who pushed me to be my best, coaches who pushed me to be my best. And so it's important for us to wrap our arms around some of these young people and try to push them as much as we can. You know, the last caller talked about jobs, and we think about, you know, what type of jobs? You know, are we talking about jobs of the past or jobs of the future? We look at the growth in careers like education. We both in educators. We look at technology and engineering and science and all these other fields that are growing. In Baltimore, you have those jobs that are being created on Zeke's side of the city. You have, you know, Hopkins on my side of the city. We have University of Maryland. You know, what types of biotech jobs are being created? And I look at what University of Maryland is doing with their Cura Scholars programs and taking these young people, working with their schools and giving them the resources and the skills to be competitive in those fields later on. But also, in the last caller mentioned this, it's procurement's important. So if we can have Hopkins and Maryland supporting local businesses, whether it's just catering or whether it's laundry service, whatever it is, that's also creating jobs within these communities. But you have to see the possibilities. For me, it was seeing folks who, even if I couldn't be there, I could see that it was possible, and speaking positivity and possibility into some of the lives of these young people. But it's challenging when you see your parents and your aunts and uncles struggling. I know it was challenging for me. But again, you know, all those things are possible, but you have to have all hands on deck to do it.
And Zeke Cohen, just got a couple minutes left here, but reflect for a little bit now. You're just about to reach your year anniversary of being sworn in as part of the council that runs this city, this troubled city with such great potential. You came from a premise like John Bullock as an activist. You were an educator. You were involved with young people. What is government's capacity to change the culture in ways that need to be changed so that everybody can move forward?
Absolutely. So I think government at its best can be a voice of people. People in everyday communities, our business community, that we can be the space where we convene, we bring people together, and we fight for the causes that we all care about, like a living wage, like reducing violence, like investing more into our schools. We didn't get to talk about the Kerwin Commission, but the importance of having adequately funded schools. And you mentioned, Tom, that I used to be a teacher. I'm also about to have a daughter. And I want her to grow up in a city that is safe, that is fair, that is just, where everybody, whether it's my daughter or a young woman growing up in Sandtown Winchester or Harlem Park or O'Donnell Heights or Canton, has the same level of opportunity, that they can grow up and thrive. And so to me, you know, it's an incredible honor to be here with my colleague John Bullock. You know, I think both of us were government nerds to some extent growing up, and, you know, studied this stuff. And I just think we are on the forefront of a great, powerful moment in our city and in our country, where cities need to step up and need to be the places where progressive values can live and where justice can happen. And I think, to a previous caller's point, we are right now in the business of redressing many of the sins of the past. We didn't get here overnight, and it's going to take a lot of work from all sectors to create the type of city where everybody, my daughter included, feels great living and growing up.
All right, we're going to have to call it there. But John Bullock, Zeke Cohen, I very much appreciate you guys coming by, and we will certainly have you on again, and we'll stay in touch.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks, Tom.
Zeke Cohen is the first district councilman. John Bullock is the 9th district councilman here on the Baltimore City Council. We've got a link to the City Council website on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, a conversation with Heather Mazier, the former Democratic primary gubernatorial candidate, who now has a new project called Soul Force Politics, which includes a podcast. podcast and women empowerment workshops. We'll explore the intersection of what she calls inner wisdom and external actions and how that can animate political movements tomorrow here on Midday. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russert reviews The Lion King, that's over at the Hippodrome. Thanks to Dangerously Delicious Pies for lunch today. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. Thanks to everybody who made a donation to WYPR yesterday on Giving Tuesday. We very much appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. On behalf of the entire Midday team, thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.